Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It is our spring membership drive. More about that in a moment. We're talking about bird identification today, specifically bird identification in 12 steps. That's part of the title of a new book by Steve Howell and Brian Sullivan, both birding experts, The Peterson Guide to Bird Identification in 12 Steps. Brian Sullivan also works on eBird and digital publications at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. He lives in California and joins us by phone. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also joining us is Resources Manager at Columbus and Franklin County Metro Parks, John Watts. John has authored or co-authored many articles on wildlife management, habitat restoration, and natural history topics, and he recently co-authored the book, The Birds of Hocking County, Ohio. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. This is our spring membership drive. Remember, listener support is the foundation of our budget. Please make your gift right now at WOSU.org or by calling 866-897-9678. For $10 a month as a sustainer, we'll send you the book, The Peterson Guide to Bird Identification in 12 Steps. This book is co-authored by Brian Sullivan, one of our guests today on All Sides. Identifying birds can be overwhelming, especially when you're just getting started. Where and how do you start? How about with this great book? Make a gift of $10 a month as a sustainer or a one-time gift of $120 and get this book as your thank you gift today. It is a classic Peterson guide with the heavy-duty cover, and it's the good size. You can put it in your backpack and make away with it on your new birding experiences. 866-897-9678. Or go online to WOSU.org. John Watts, I wanted to start with you and just brief, just rank Ohio as a birding destination. You know, what do we have here?
Well, for us in Ohio, I think the spring migration, particularly up in Sandusky Bay and Western Lake Erie at Ottawa, where they hold part of the greatest week of birding, is clearly one of the hot spots here in the state of Ohio. In that spring time frame of late April and May, it's easy to see well over 200 species of birds, see some of the large migratory fallouts that they rest on the south shore of Lake Erie, wait for the south winds, fuel up, and then kind of blow across the Great Lakes to their breeding grounds in the north. Here in central Ohio, we kind of benefit by having a lot of stream corridors run through the
Columbus.
What
does that mean?
The stream corridors are like our riparian areas, our forests along our streams, and a lot of birds migrate these watershed patterns. So here in Columbus, we also kind of get the benefit of having kind of these little highways of water and forests that these birds migrate through on their way to Lake Erie, particularly in the spring and then again in the fall when they return.
Brian Sullivan, in the introduction to the book, you write that it can be overwhelming for the new birder. Do you remember back when you were a new birder?
Not really. I've been birding since I was about 5 years old. At that time, we were using a Peterson field guide to birds of eastern North America, and I remember sitting at my feeder and getting into birding very slowly by only watching birds that were coming to the feeder and trying to match up the pictures in the book with what I was seeing at the feeder. And, I think the approach that we've taken with this book is to break down what it is to actually identify birds, that process, into 12 sort of digestible bits. That might seem a little counterintuitive to someone coming at this from a new birder's perspective.
Right. They might think you're going to say the shape of the wing or the shape of the beak or something like that, and it's something a little more farther away than that.
Exactly. I mean, most people think of bird identification as, you're looking at fine points of plumage or structure of the bird's bill and things like that to differentiate the species. And while that's true, there's a lot of things that you can do before you get to that step. In fact, structures and plumage are steps 9 and 10. So there's a lot to get to before you even really look at the bird at that level.
when I was reading the book, I think I had a good example in my mind of what you're talking about as far as location and where are you and are you getting your feet wet and what time of year is it and that kind of thing. We live by a river. We saw something big flying the river way between the trees on either side. And we thought, well, that has to probably is going to be a blue heron. It's big. They like to do that. And we were right. I mean, once we got close enough and we got a good look at it, that's what it was. It was a heron. I'm not sure exactly what kind, but it was what it was. But we weren't looking at it specifically. We were looking at the behavior, where it was and how it was flying and that kind of a thing.
Yeah. And you can actually use knowledge of location and habitat and season to limit your choices very quickly to great blue heron for that species. Because if you're in central Ohio at this time of year and you see a blue heron, there's really only one option. It's going to be the great blue heron.
Right, right. So you say that it can be overwhelming for a new birder in your introduction, but you don't remember when you first started birding. How did you suss out what a new birder would need to know?
Well, both Steve and I have spent our lives helping people identify birds. Steve is a professional tour guide for Wings Tour Company, and I work at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology and frequently lead bird walks and trips of various kinds. So we're constantly in contact with birders of varying skill levels. So we're sort of always teaching people these steps. And we decided, you know, a lot of books, particularly bird identification guides, have very brief treatments of these topics in the introduction. And I think our idea was to write a book that was basically an introduction to bird watching that doesn't really contain information about how to identify individual species as much as it does help you get into the process of identifying birds.
You're kind of, John Watt, sort of nodding like, yeah, I was wondering when you first got into birding.
Well, I must be a little older than Brian because I started with a golden guide, which were little guides that I think mine was $1.95.
Like the golden books?
Yeah, the little teeny golden books. There was a whole series of those, and they were kind of the picture guide I started with. I think they were $1.95, and mine's held together with masking tape to this day and sits on the shelf.
You still have it?
I still have
it.
But yeah, it's kind of the same thing. You know, I grew up in the southern part of Ohio, and, you know, you're kind of out and around. You know, mom said, get out of the house. And so you would come across different things in fence rows and the woods as you were just kind of out and around, and you kind of wondered what they were. And so you just were around this stuff all the time. And so, you know, my interest got piqued later when I started school. And, you know, as Brian says, you know, it is overwhelming. My first trip to Lake Erie, the trees are full of birds and you're trying to do a college course or, you know, a lot of people are just doing it for fun, but it is very overwhelming. And, you know, it's kind of, I like the idea of starting with images and shapes and where you're at and things, and then start to learn the specific patterns of birds later.
You quoted Ken Kaufman, Brian Sullivan, in the book, a longtime friend of this show, by the way, who says that a good birder is someone who enjoys birding.
Yes, that is a great Ken Kaufman quote and couldn't be more true. I mean, I think that we've written this book to appeal to people who enjoy birds at all levels. It can be people who like to watch birds at their feeders, all the way down to people that chase birds all around the world. And as Ken points out, you know, the real key to birds or sort of enjoying birds is just having that passion and interest in this as something to do in your life.
You say it starts with the simplest step, the 12 steps, and that's taxonomy, which doesn't sound simple. And that's how a species is organized. And it's the way you write about that is pretty funny. I mean, because it's all over the place now. There's now that genetics is being brought into the equation. It's changing things up a lot. But what about taxonomy and how they're organized?
Well, the reason that we started with taxonomy was, you know, in the beginning of that chapter, we point out a couple of examples of actually misidentifying things that aren't birds as birds. And you know, taxonomy can be a challenging thing to think about. When you look at a bird field guide, there's anywhere between 600 and 900 species in there for North America. And it just doesn't make any sense when you look at all of those birds. And the reason we started with taxonomy was just to provide some background on how birds are organized. And really, you know, the taxonomic structure of a field guide isn't often very useful from a birding perspective. You don't encounter birds in taxonomic order in the field.
Right.
You might see a great blue heron, you might see a yellow warbler, and those are very far apart taxonomically. So the idea of the taxonomy introduction was just to basically demystify some of it and write an approachable treatment of it so that people understand that taxonomy is really just the organization of names, species names, and the relationships between birds. And one thing that is useful from a taxonomic standpoint is understanding the broader differences in families of birds. So, for example, you know, shorebirds do a certain thing, warblers do a different thing, and they're all sort of shaped similarly. You know, vireos are different from hummingbirds and things like that. So learning those broader groupings and some of the traits that are shared across those groups can be really helpful.
What are some of the groups in Central Ohio that people come across that sometimes they're surprised about gemmots?
Well, I think, you know, we've had some rare gulls this winter when it got, really cold. Things froze up. We had a very rare gull that was only the third or fourth record right here in downtown Columbus at Green Lawn Dam. It was a mew gull, more of a western species. That was very exciting at the last week of December. So we do get some of these rarities of that nature. We get some other things that are more localized. We have bald eagles and ospreys nesting almost within sight of
right.
downtown Columbus now, which as somebody that's been in this for over 30 years, 30 years ago, I would have never thought that we would have ospreys nesting in downtown in places like Scioto Audubon Metro Park or right along the Scioto River. We have multiple birds in the county now, and I think that's really fantastic. I think that's something that is of surprising that I've seen. We have sandhill cranes, which are state endangered, nesting here in Franklin County, out at Pickerington Ponds and some of our other wetland restoration areas. So you see those things that 30 years ago, you would have kind of wondered if that's what somebody really saw. A sandhill crane was reported in Knox County in the late 80s, I remember, and everybody drove there to see it because it was a rarity. We see them flying, migrating through the county now here in Central Ohio. If you're lucky, you might catch a flock of 200, 300 of them in the fall.
Wow.
And it's a spectacular sight when you see that.
I remember when I traveled about an hour to Tuscarawas County to see a bald eagle nest. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't think I was lucky enough to see the eagle, any of the eagles, but mm-hmm. they knew that they were nesting there. And that was pretty exciting. And now...
Yeah, in 1985, there were only really two nests of bald eagles in the state. Both were up on Lake Erie.
Mm-hmm.
They were both visible, but for several years, that was it. We were down to between two and six nesting pair. You know, now we're, I believe, up around 400 known pair for the state of Ohio, and there's probably ones out there that we're not aware of.
This is 89.7 NPR News. It is our spring membership drive, and our guests this hour, John Watts from the Metro Parks and Brian Sullivan, who is the co-author of our thank you gift today. For a gift of $10 a month as a sustainer, you get the book, Peterson Guide to Bird Identification in 12 Steps. This book starts with the basics of birding and helps anyone get into the hobby. The book is hardcover. You can take it with you out into the field. It is written in a helpful conversational style. I'm really enjoying it. It has numerous photos. Get this great book as a thank you gift this hour. $10 a month as a sustainer or a one-time gift of $120. Go to WOSU.org or call 866-897-9678. Thanks to Sarah Orlos in Columbus for your pledge and also Alyssa Peterson in Dublin for your pledge. Get this great book as a thank you gift. It's $10 a month as a sustainer or a one-time gift of $120. It's brand new. It's written in a friendly, non-intimidating way. Like I said, Brian Sullivan, I'm really enjoying it. At times, the book is even humorous, which is why I'm enjoying it. New birders can get some basics from this book. Experienced birders can pick up some vital tips. Maybe you're an experienced birder. You're trying to break somebody into the game. This would be a great book to give them. It'd be a great gift. Go to WOSU.org or call 866-897-9678 or go to WOSU.org and make that show of support right now. This isn't the only birding program we do all year. We do three or four a year. We have fabulous people on like Ken Kaufman, Julie Zickafoos. This isn't abnormal. This is just an opportunity because we have this brand new book to offer you, Peterson Guide to Bird Identification in 12 Steps. 866-897-9678 or go online to WOSU.org. Now, location, you compared birding another step in the process is you compared it to real estate. And what is the deal with location, Brian Sullivan?
Well, bird identification is really about limiting your realistic choices. And when you pick up a field guide to North American birds, as I said earlier, there's between 600 and 900 species in it, depending on the book. And, you know, one thing that birders, or beginning birders in particular, often fail to do is look at the range map. Every species in the book has a range map associated with it, and that map will tell you where the bird breeds, where it migrates, and where it winters. And really, location is the first thing you need to understand about sort of where you are in the world in relation to every bird in that book. So if you see a bird that's, as I just said, obviously a heron and it's blue and you're in Ohio and it's big, you really only have one choice. But, you know, if you're somewhere else in the world, you may have multiple choices. And the thing with location is knowing where you are can, and by sort of cross-referencing those range maps really quickly, the first step is just saying, okay, well, that bird doesn't breed here, and it's breeding season, and I'm in Ohio, so it can't be that.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first step, you know, you're really taking sort of a realistic look. Those range maps are built off of many, many years of observation and you know, knowledge has gone into those maps. And one thing that I often hear from people sort of is an offhand comment, well, birds have wings, they can fly. That's true, but bird distribution is very, very predictable. And we can often know exactly what we're looking at by just limiting our options very quickly based on the location. And, you know, as John points out, rarities do occur. People love to see rarities, and birders are often driven by rarities. But rare birds really are rare. And the first thing you need to do is rule out the common one.
I still like to just look at the red-breasted woodpecker and the blue jays and the the cardinals in my backyard. I still enjoy those. Do you still enjoy just seeing the everyday birds, John Watts?
I think that's one of the great things about birding and bird watching is it's accessible pretty much to almost everybody. It can be really that lifelong experience that, you know, you get to a point, maybe you can't travel as much, but you can still see a lot just in your backyards. And there's always things to learn. You always see different behaviors just with maybe the 25 or 30 species that you might see in your backyard, something as common as a blue jay or a cardinal. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, we had some snow last week after a few of the migrants have come back and, you know, seeing how, you know, things adapt to that and how they might act for a few days. There's still things that you can enjoy just in your own backyard. And there's nothing wrong with just enjoying the common birds. I think, as Brian said, you know, rare birds are rare birds for a good reason. And, enjoying the common stuff, those are the ones that we're most likely to encounter, within our given local area or region on a weekly basis.
And, you know, the more I watch birds too, Brian Sullivan, I notice that, there's a cardinal and it's another cardinal, but I'm starting to notice that not every bird, they don't all look alike.
Right. Yeah, so variation is a step in the book. It's step 11. And understanding variation in birds is something that comes sort of later in most people's bird observation sort of arc. You know, birds are variable on many levels. There's age-related variation in plumages. There's species that are sex variation, like cardinals.
Mm-hmm.
There's seasonal variation in plumages. Some have breeding and non-breeding plumages. And then there's also geographic variation, which, you know, means that a red-tailed hawk, which is a very familiar bird, for example, breeding in Ohio can look very different from a red-tailed hawk breeding here in California or in Alaska. So understanding those complexities is something that over time, even looking at common birds, you'll notice, you know, the red-tailed hawks that show up in Ohio in the winter, they look a little different than the ones that breed there in the summer because they're coming out of the boreal forest and they're darker and more heavily marked and sort of look a little bit different. So even not observing birds in your backyard, you can see variation in a number of different ways.
Identifying birds by their songs and calls to me is one of the toughest things. I figured a few of them out now, but it feels like it's trying to learn a new language late in life. But the house wren is a small brown bird common in Ohio backyards and across the country. Let's hear a bit from the house wren. That's a pretty little sound. Do they all sound like that, John Watts?
Yeah, you'll get sometimes you'll get a little bit of a regional infliction or almost an accent, if you would, to some things. But, you know, for us here in Central Ohio, you know, if you put a house wren box up in your yard somewhere, there's a very good likelihood that that's a bird that you can attract to most of your yards. They like a little bit of a shrubby border somewhere. But, you know, if you've got a larger lot with a little bit of a woods, maybe on the edge of Columbus, you might have a couple to pair. They're pretty adaptable to humans. They take to humans real well. And, you know, you can sit on the porch and they kind of get used to you being there and you can kind of watch them come and go. But it's a very common species for us here in Central Ohio.
How long, Brian Sullivan, does it take? I mean, like I said, sound is a struggle for me sometimes. I know the jay, I know the chickadee, I know, you know, the red-breasted woodpecker, but it seems so alien. I don't know how people are able to just listen to a cacophony and pick out different birds.
Yeah, it's definitely a learned skill and something that you have to practice at. But I will say that as you become more proficient with bird sounds, it really does replace your eyes in detecting birds, at least. And identifying birds, actually. So when I'm on my morning walk around the block in my neighborhood, I detect and identify probably 95% of what I record, record an eBird, for example, on my bird list for the walk by ear. I know every sound of every bird. And as you get familiar, and I would recommend starting in your backyard and try to, you know, understand what blue jay sounds like and red-bellied woodpecker and pileated woodpecker and all these other sounds that should be fairly easy to hear and fairly easy to tie back to a bird. The thing you have to do is hear it and then see it and make the connection and remember that connection. And then as you get better at it, over time, you'll begin to be able to step outside and immediately identify those sounds of all the familiar common birds. But you might hear something different in the mix, and that different thing could be a migrant warbler, maybe a Cape May warbler singing in your yard or something like that one May morning. That's how you really begin to pick out different things in your backyard habitat. But starting small and becoming familiar with the common birds is really the key to learning birds by ear.
I was walking the other day, walking the dog, and I heard a bird, and it sounded like, and I know I have hockey on the brain, but because the Jackets made it into the playoffs. But it sounded like, let's go Jackets. Let's go Jackets. And that's how I remembered it. But I kind of had to rack my brain for a while because I never wrote it down. And another recommendation you have is, Brian Sullivan, is to bring something, write it down. Take notes.
Yep.
So
the final step in the book is to write it down. And you know, the write it down can mean write it down physically in a notebook, or it could mean write it down digitally. And
record
it. With the advent of the incredible rectangle in everyone's pocket that is a supercomputer, you can make a recording of that bird call. You can take a snapshot of it and use apps like Merlin from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology to identify those things for you. So there are tools out there that can help you with that sort of thing. And those tools are advancing rapidly.
John Watts, do you want to venture a guess on what I guess at what I heard?
I'd guess Carolina chickadee.
Okay.
If I had to guess.
Okay. A very plaintive sound, yeah. But
they're calling right now. It's part of their spring calls that's out. So listen to that and see if it's close.
I was wondering about a singing white-throated sparrow.
Possibly that. They're really moving through. They were singing a lot this morning. It's warmed up here.
Oh, yeah, finally.
We've had heavy south winds. We had gusty winds yesterday. They're forecasted more 30-mile-an-hour winds out of the south ahead of a big front. So things here migration-wise are about a week behind in terms of numbers. A few things are filtering in, but the difference between today and yesterday and today and tomorrow morning could be substantial in terms of bird movement here in the central part of and southern part of Ohio.
Thanks to Patricia and Thomas Hubble in Delaware for your pledge. This is listener supported, 89.7 NPR News, and this is All Sides with Ann Fisher joining us this morning. You just heard from John Watts from the Metro Parks, and Brian Sullivan is on the phone. He's co-author of a brand new book. It's called The Peterson Guide to Bird Identification in 12 Steps. That book is our thank you gift today. For $10 a month as a sustainer, get this book. Your $10 a month gift can be withdrawn from your checking account or charged to your credit card. Go to WOSU.org or call 866-897-9678. This great book is designed to improve your birding skills. It's to help you overcome that overwhelming feeling of what in the world is going on up there. If you're a new birder, it will help you develop essential skills and knowledge. If you're an experienced birder, you'll get great insights that will help you improve in the field. This book is full of information and beautiful photographs. That's $10 a month as a sustaining member or a one-time gift of $120. We're locally run. We're locally programmed. 89.7 NPR News exists to make sure that everyone in our wonderful corner of Ohio has access to vital news and information. With locally focused programs like All Sides with Ann Fisher, 89.7 NPR News addresses the issues that impact our community at local, regional, and national levels. It's valuable radio, but it relies on your donations to keep it on the air. So please give now at WOSU.org or call 866-897-9678. Make that call right now while we're on the air so I can thank you in person. That's 866-897-9678 or go online to WOSU.org. It only takes a few minutes. Now, if you have a question for our guests, that's another number. It's 614-292-8513. We welcome your questions. If you're a new birder, if you've been birding since you were watching the bird feeder in the backyard when you were a kid, it doesn't matter. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Just as far as the sound goes, you said to record it, we could just go ahead and record it. And then what do you do? Is there some place to match it to? Brian Sullivan?
Well, yeah, so there's a couple of things you can do. There's eBird, which is a website and tool that's run by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, and you can upload your sound recording there. Right now, the best place to probably get an identification on a sound recording is a website called Xenocanto, where you can upload an unidentified sound and then have the community actually identify the sound for you. There's not a computer-driven model that can identify bird sound recordings yet. And the reason for that is it's very difficult to tease out the sound you've recorded from the background noise. And there's often people talking and cars going by and other bird sounds on top of the one that is the target. So that technology, the artificial intelligence that's required to process sound like that, is developing rapidly, and I expect in the next 5 years or so, we'll be able to do that in real time. But as of now, a human being is required to identify those bird recordings that you might make. Computer vision, on the other hand, can identify your bird photos. And we do have an app at the lab called Merlin, and it has a tool in it that you can take a snapshot of a bird even with your iPhone and zoom the picture up, and Merlin will use artificial intelligence and data from eBird and all of this processing to identify your bird image. And it gets it right about 98% of the time.
Wow. But people still like to go birding together. Now, that was something that I didn't realize, that birding was a group activity, John Watts. And it's a group activity in Central Ohio as well, right?
Yes, there's a number of groups. In fact, we're doing a number of programs in the Park District over the next few weeks. People can look on our website, www.metroparks.net, and go to our program schedule. But we have a program out at Darby. We got a couple of programs coming up at Blacklick, Blendon Woods. I'm leading a hike at Clear Creek Metro Park on the 21st. We have a beginner's bird program up at Glacier Ridge on the 26th, and we have a couple of hikes the last weekend, first weekend of May, at High Banks. We also have a couple of nature centers at Blacklick, Blendon, and High Banks that have bird feeders there where people can sit and watch. We have volunteers and naturalist staff that can assist in helping to identify what you're seeing. But yeah, it's a group activity. Sometimes the groups can be fairly large.
Yeah.
Maybe a little too large, but almost everybody's got a group of people that they bird with. And, you know, there is a lot of enjoyment in birding by yourself. But, you know, being able to see things and share with others, that's kind of part of the overall, I think, activity of bird watching at the same time.
It probably also, Brian Sullivan, I mean, it helps you check yourself. And when I was with my husband the other day and we thought that was a heron and, you know, we talked about it. It was helpful.
Yeah, it's definitely helpful to have multiple observers. You know, it's good to have that sort of second person or even more people seeing different things on the bird or thinking about it slightly differently, especially if it's a difficult identification. I've been in lots of cases where it's really taken a group of people to get around to the right ID on any particular bird.
Let's listen to some more birds. A colorful bird that Ohioans might find munching on seed at the bird feeder is rose-breasted grosbeak. It's a good way to find rose-breasted grosbeaks is to listen for them. Let's hear a bit. I was listening to the bird in the background. I don't know if you could hear it, Brian, but the one diddle 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 in the way in the background. Is that an easy bird to confuse, John Watts?
Yeah, it can be confused with a few other things. It has one of the things that stands out when they migrate through. They'll be rolling into Central Ohio here within the next 10 to 14 days.
Okay.
Some stick around and breed in Ohio. A number are headed on to the northern Great Lakes in Canada. They've got a very loud I think of them singing in circles, like a whistling circle kind of over and over, but kind of similar to an American robin, which is a very common bird that we have. And so people that do leave seed in their feeders a little bit later than you think of in the winter months, a lot of times the males and females both will come into seed feeders as they begin to arrive here in late April and early May.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It is our spring membership drive. Your support pays for the programs you listen to every day. And in return for your contribution, we're offering you a great gift, The Peterson Guide to Bird Identification in 12 Steps. It's a brand new book. You can read it. You can consult it. Read it again and again as you go through your birding journey. Share it with others. Even the most experienced bird watchers can garner insights from this book. And you'll be supporting public radio with your gift today. Go to WOSU.org or call 866-897-9678. Make a gift of $10 a month as a sustainer and get the book, The Peterson Guide to Bird Identification in 12 Steps. This book starts with the basics and builds your skills in a manageable way. You can give $10 a month or a one-time gift of $120 a month. Go to WOSU.org or call 866-897-9678. And remember, we're asking you to give what you can afford to give. If that doesn't fit into your budget, maybe $5 a month will. Give what you can afford to give to show your support. It'll make listening to 89.7 NPR News a lot easier as days go by. 866-897-9678 or go online to WOSU.org. You just get a really good feeling when you make that show of support. I suppose it's also like kind of like that really good feeling you get when you set out on a walk and you actually find something that you're looking for. Does that ever get old, Jen Watts?
I don't think so. I think as you know, as Brian mentioned earlier, and Ken says, you know, people do it because they enjoy doing it. And I was out yesterday. I'm fortunate to be out some, and you know, seeing birds that you've seen over and over and over again, but they're kind of returning here in the spring and starting to set up breeding territories, and you know, kind of seeing that rebirth. I think you know, for me, I like all parts of natural history, but I think. You know, between now and the end of June, I think from a natural history standpoint and, you know, kind of a wildlife watching standpoint, when you figure in migration and the breeding bird season, yeah, I think it's really ecologically one of the more interesting and truly spectacular things that, you can observe in, around here. It's really interesting.
Someone once said to me that they think of birding like fishing, where you're just doing a lot of waiting. And I tried to explain to them, Brian Sullivan, that it's really not like that. You're always moving around and you're always looking. You're not just sitting.
Yeah, I mean, for me, birding is it's the sense of discovery and renewal and all of the things that, John just mentioned. Every time you go in the field, you're seeing something different. And it doesn't matter if it's a different species, but it is something different each time. It's this, could be the same bird that you saw yesterday just doing something differently or in a more interesting way. Being able to observe nature carefully is, I don't think there's any other group of animals on the planet, any other taxa, that allow you to do that in the way that birds do. Birds are everywhere in every ecosystem. Anywhere you go, you can be engaged with birds and watching interesting things.
And they're not really concerned about us down here, are they?
Well, when you say they, you mean the birds?
Yeah.
Well, they can be. It depends what they're doing. If they're nesting, they can be highly concerned about humans. If they're migrating,
okay,
maybe not. But yeah, I mean, birds can be, they can be pretty protective over their nest sites if they view you as an intruder. Mockingbird's a good example of a bird that can make its presence known by trying to attack your head and knock the hat off your head if you get too close to its nest.
Yeah, a friend of mine produced a lot of videos. She would ride her bike a certain route, and every time she did, a bird would attack her. Do you think it's probable that there was a nest nearby?
Probably, yeah. I mean, birds don't generally attack people for no reason. It's almost always related to some sort of nest defense.
Is it different, John Watts, leading groups when there's a lot of children involved?
Well, each group's a little bit different, you know, given the, you know, the different skills and, you know, maybe where you're at and things. But, you know, you kind of always have to maybe look at it a little bit differently in terms of, you know, what you're trying to get across to the group. You know, you might not be quite as concerned about identifying every species as maybe trying to point out, as you know, as Brian mentioned earlier, you know, what are they doing and kind of why are they doing it? as a way of really getting kind of that ecological and connection with nature, particularly with children across, you know, to kind of figure out some of the identification with children later. It's good that they can identify, you know, some birds that come to the feeders or something that you see on a walk, or they can recall it later. But, you know, using that as kind of a catalyst to, you know, what's that animal doing and why is it doing it and why is it in that particular area versus somewhere else? You know, why is it a particular color versus another color? You know, concepts of that can be really valuable in connecting children with nature and, you know, recruiting people, young people to birdwatch as well.
Yeah. What do you say, Brian Sullivan, about getting, I mean, you guys both got involved in it kind of naturally as children, but is it something that children take to naturally?
I don't think that bird identification necessarily is something that kids take readily to, but identifying with birds is something that I think they do.
Okay.
I have a six-year-old daughter, and she loves to look out the window at the birds on the fence and at the feeder, but she's not really interested in them from an identification standpoint, but she is interested in what they're doing and if they're a family, if they have babies, and, you know, all of the natural history aspects of what's going on with these birds in our yard are highly interesting to her, but she really doesn't care how to separate the mourning dove from the Eurasian collared dove just yet.
Just yet. Dave in Newark, you're on the air with Brian Sullivan, co-author of The Peterson Guide to Bird Identification in 12 Steps, and also John Watts of the Columbus and Franklin County Metro Parks. Hi, Dave.
Hello. Hi, Ann. Love your show.
Thank you.
And hi, gentlemen. I've got a bird question for you. I live in Newark and sort of out in the country a little bit, and we have a fire pit out in the backyard. And when it's not in use, we've got a metal cover, a grill type cover on top of it. Anyway, there's a robin that comes, and for like 10 minutes, it will jump up on the top of the grill, then jump down onto the ground and circle the fire pit, and then jump up on the grill. And it just, I wondered if there was any kind of behavioral explanation for that.
Thoughts, John Watts?
Well, there's something there that's intriguing. You know, sometimes they see a reflection or they of themselves or of at least an image that they, you know, kind of think is, you know, another bird. You know, they may have had an experience of, you know, was that grill cover open at some point? And they, you know, they found something in there to eat. They found something there. There's something there that is continuing to draw them back to that. So, you know, something of that nature is obviously drawn that individual bird to that location.
What do you think, Brian Sullivan?
Well, I had a question. When the robin drops to the ground, is it doing anything when it gets to the ground? Is it pulling worms out or eating crickets or grabbing anything off the ground?
No, that's just it. It is, it just sort of hops around, looks around a little bit, and then hops back up. My son actually recorded when it happened a couple years ago, and he posted, posted it to YouTube, Crazy Bird. And but we didn't get any response.
Does it still do it? I mean, Dave in Newark, I mean, is it still, this has been going on for years?
It's happened more than once, but, it, you know, related to that, we do see birds, and we have a bird feeder, and we see all kinds of birds. I've got tons of stories. One of the most interesting one, very briefly, we had a hawk that came in and killed a baby squirrel, carried it away, and then it came back and destroyed the nest. And I thought that was really weird. But anyway, back on this bird situation, the other birds, like cardinals and other birds, will come and they may do what the robin does for, you know, 20 seconds. They'll hop up to the top and look around, hop down, walk around, get it. But this one bird just, you know, did it for 10 minutes nonstop. Like it was, you know,
obsessed. Yeah.
Yeah.
Crazy bird.
Well, thank you. I'll let you continue with the show.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks for that call. If you have a call, question, or comment, 614-292-8513 is the number. If you want to email us, you can at allsides@wosu.org. Remember, this is listener-supported 89.7 NPR News. And this is All Sides with Ann Fisher. Joining us this morning, John Watts from the Metro Parks and Brian Sullivan, who is co-author of the book, The Peterson Guide to Bird Identification in 12 Steps. That book is our thank you gift today. We appreciate your support. We want to show it by giving you a thank you gift for $10 a month as a sustainer. You get this book. Your $10 a month gift can be withdrawn from your checking account or charged to your credit card. Go to WOSU.org or call 866-897-9678 or go online to WOSU.org. Your support pays for the programs you listen to every day, and in return for your contribution, we're offering you this great gift. It matters to us that you support us, not only financially, but kind of emotionally, being out there saying, yeah, this is something that I value. And we're asking you to also to put a monetary value to it. Think about what you can afford, about what you value it, the program at, not just All Sides, but everything you listen to on 89.7 NPR News, from Morning Edition to, you know, All Things Considered, to the fun stuff on the weekend, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, to, Fresh Air with Terry Gross. So there's so much. There's such a massive variety to choose from every day. That's why you probably listen all day. 614-292-8513 is the number to call if you have a question. But if you want to show your support and tell us that you value what we're doing for you every day, the number is 866-897-9678 or go online to WOSU.org. We only have about 8 minutes left this hour. Please show your support right now, 866-897-9678 or go online to WOSU.org. And Nils and Columbus are on the air. Hi, Nils.
Hello, Ann. Love your show.
Thank you.
So I have a question for the gentleman on right now.
Okay.
So we're at my parents' house. I just recently moved out, but we have two bird feeders and a bird bath. And about two and a half years ago, there was a cardinal that showed up, and he had like a broke, it looks like it's broken, essentially, his left leg.
Mm-hmm.
And we just started feeding him at the feeders, and then we realized he would come back every day and hang out for like 5 minutes, and then he would leave. And he all winter, all summer, all spring, the past two and a half years, he's been coming back. So I was just wondering if cardinals had, like a migrational pattern where they leave, or if they stay forever, and or like how long might live, because we call him one leg.
Okay. You recognize him because he's only working with one leg.
Yeah, like it's the other one's like completely bent in an opposite direction, but he still flies around and hops around and everything.
He's a survivor, John Watts.
Yeah.
our cardinals here are kind of what we call they're a permanent resident, which means that you might find those individual birds year round. Other birds, you know, you may see a blue jay in the summer and a blue jay in the winter. Oftentimes, those may not be the same birds because blue jays do show a pretty big migratory pattern. The ones we see here in the winter may be some of the more northern birds that have left Canada and have come down into our region for the winter. But birds like our cardinals, they're permanent residents. You'll see them year round. It's probably a resident of that yard. They don't tend to have great big territories where they move any great distances for a bird like that, particularly if they have a source of food and water around. That's going to keep them, you know, kind of in that city environment and probably just a resident of that particular yard or two right there.
That's nice. Nils, thanks a lot for that call. I appreciate it. Thanks for listening. Email from Paul. He says, birding is a hobby that can be started with minimal financial investment. You don't need a $1,000 pair of binoculars or a bunch of gear. I'm an experienced birder, and I never get tired of my cardinals, jays, goldfinches, etc., the regulars at my feeders. I've been a volunteer in Metro Parks and helped naturalists on bird walks and help with the Christmas bird count. I would suggest that beginners plan on helping with the annual Christmas count. It's a good way for beginners to get experience in the field with experienced birders. Thanks. Great program as usual. And I'm a WOSU supporter. Thank you very much, Paul. Thanks for your support. Anybody else out there want to join that category of being a WOSU supporter? A supporter of the kind of things you hear on 89.7 NPR News every single day? You can call 866-897-9678 or go online to WOSU.org. Don't wait. 866-897-9678 or go online to WOSU.org and show your support right now. So what about that Christmas bird count? What happens? Is that a national thing or is it just local or what? John Watts?
That's a national effort that we get in and around. Generally, they start about, I think it's around the third week of December and run up through about the 7th of January. Many of these counts go back. The first count, I believe, was done, I believe it was in 1903, 1913. Brian might want to chime in on that. But there's a number of them in and around Columbus. They have compilers. It's kind of a group effort. The great thing about winter birding is, you know, if you don't mind a little bit of cold from time to time, you have a smaller number of birds to work with, which when people talk about being overwhelmed, it is a nice time here in Central Ohio to start. You know, most of our counts around Central Ohio will probably be somewhere in the 40 to 70 species range, depending on where you're at, what kind of maybe the winter conditions. If the lakes are frozen, the ducks have moved on. If they're open and it hasn't been real cold, you'll see more waterfowl around some of our lakes and reservoirs. But it is a really good time to get together because you do have a lot of experienced people out birding with groups, you know, in metro parks, through Columbus Audubon Society, areas of that nature. And as I say, the neat part of this is that, you know, many of these counts have been going on for decades, and you can see the changes in birds based upon the habitat changes. You know, maybe there's been development, or places that were once cornfields are now, you know, maybe they're restoration areas, or the land use has changed, or the forest has become more mature over that period of time. And so you get a little bit of a history lesson in that at the same time.
Is it big out in California, Brian Sullivan?
Yeah, Christmas bird count is a big effort all across North America. It's been going on more than 100 years, as John just pointed out. It's a great way to get out there around Christmas time and see what birds are around. We have a similar effort called the Great Backyard Bird Count that's run through the Cornell Lab and Audubon. That's in mid-February. That's a great way to get people out and see what's happening with birds in the late winter. And then in the spring, coming up on the 5th of May this year, we have the Global Big Day, which is an effort that's run through eBird and the Cornell Lab, where the idea is to engage birders all over the world to see how many species we can find in one 24-hour period. And I think last year we had nearly 7,000 species recorded around the world in eBird on that day. So we'll be looking to do that again on 5 May, and it's a great opportunity to take new birders out, new people out, and introduce them to birding at a time of year when they can expect to see a lot of great stuff in Ohio.
Thanks to Rebecca Paul in Columbus for your pledge. Also, Marianne Burr in London for your pledge. You listen to 89.7 NPR News because you treasure a vibrant and open-minded community where people are engaged, where people work together to make Central Ohio a great place to live. That's why this station is dedicated to a two-hour daily local show like All Sides. Not every community has it. That's why this station, we're here in Columbus, Powell, Grove City, Pickerington, and beyond, London, for instance, and we stand behind the service that you care about and rely on. There is a difference between a station that just gets by and one that's the centerpiece of a vibrant civic community like ours. That difference is you and your donation. Just a couple minutes left. Visit WOSU.org or call 866-897-9678. Brian Sullivan, I want to thank you for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Ann, and thanks, John.
Brian Sullivan is co-author of The Peterson Guide to Bird Identification in 12 Steps. And also, John Watts, thanks to you. We'll post a link to our website to the Columbus and Franklin County Metro Parks events for birding coming up in the next few weeks.
Okay, thank you very much. Thanks to you as well, Brian.
John Watts is the resource manager at Columbus and Franklin County Metro Parks. He recently co-authored The Birds of Hocking County, Ohio. You're listening to WOSU-FM and HD1 Columbus. Remember, the difference between a station that just gets by and one that's the centerpiece of a vibrant civic community like ours, that difference is you and your donation. Visit WOSU.org or call 866-897-9678. We're online at WOSU.org. It is a service of WOSU Public Media, 89.7 NPR News. We're global. We're local. We're here for you every day. Be here for us today. Be here for us right now. 866-897-9678 or go online to WOSU.org. Thanks, as always, for your attention. Thanks for listening. Thanks for being there. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.